A path to peace for Ukraine and Russia?
We made an offer that the Ukrainians have accepted, which is to enter into a ceasefire and into immediate negotiations to end this conflict in a way that's enduring and sustainable.
The latest on trade tariffs.
The president made his position on this quite clear with the statement that he put out. And it was a retaliatory statement due to the escalation of rhetoric that we've seen out of Ontario, Canada.
And potentially a big deal for some tiny islands.
Without legal certainty, the base cannot operate in practical terms as it should. That is bad for our national security, and it's a gift to our adversaries.
Today is Wednesday, March 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Our top story today concerns progress in U.S.-Ukraine negotiations in Saudi Arabia.
The United States praised Ukraine Tuesday for accepting a ceasefire offer and taking a step forward on the path to ending the war with Russia. Moscow is expecting to weigh in next on the American proposal. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports.
In Saudi Arabia Tuesday, Ukrainian negotiators accepted a proposal by a U.S. delegation to pause the Russia-Ukraine war for 30 days. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio.
We made an offer that the Ukrainians have accepted, which is to enter into a ceasefire and into immediate negotiations to end this conflict in a way that's enduring and sustainable. And it counts for their interests, their security, their ability to prosper as a nation.
U.S. President Donald Trump rewarded Ukraine's positive first step toward peace, said U.S. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz.
The president has decided to lift the pause on aid and on our security assistance to Ukraine going forward. And that's effective immediately.
After embracing the truce proposal, the Ukrainian delegation reiterated its commitment to peace. Head of the Ukrainian presidential office, Andriy Yermak.
For the people in the world, it's necessary once again to understand, not Ukraine started this war, but Ukraine ready for just and lasting peace.
Earlier Tuesday, Ukraine launched a massive drone attack against several Russian regions. Moscow said the attack could hinder future peace negotiations. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov.
There are no negotiations yet, so there is nothing to disrupt yet, although the emerging trend can indeed be significantly damaged.
Despite the tensions on the ground, it is expected the United States will move forward with its plans to present the ceasefire proposal to Russia next, in the hope that it will kickstart the process to achieving a lasting peace agreement. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News.
In a related story, Paris is host to two back-to-back meetings this week, gathering European Union military chiefs on how to boost their defense support to Ukraine. On Tuesday, defense ministers from the EU's five top military powers met. On Wednesday, the joint army chiefs of staff from European countries who have volunteered troops to support a future Ukraine peace deal get together.
The meetings followed an EU leaders' agreement last week on a nearly $870 billion defense plan to support Ukraine, as well as their own security, as U.S. priorities shift elsewhere. A number of EU countries also back a French call for expanding its nuclear deterrent to cover other EU members, which has received major pushback from Moscow. Lisa Bryant reports.
Speaking to top NATO and European Union military brass gathered in Paris Tuesday, Dutch Defense Minister Ruben Brekelmans stressed the urgency of boosting Europe's defense. While the transatlantic alliance is important, he said, Europeans can no longer take U.S. protection for granted.
Europe, therefore, needs to fortify its security architecture. And we don't have much time to get this right. We only have one shot.
The same message came from European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen at the European Parliament.
We need a surge in European defence, and we need it now.
The European Union's executive arm has proposed an $873 billion plan for rearming Europe and supporting Ukraine. It includes relaxing fiscal rules and some $164 billion in loans for defense investments. It has proposed increasing defense spending by an additional 1.5% of member states' GDP over 4 years. The proposed surge comes as Washington's priorities appear to be shifting, and European leaders are worried Russia may not stop at Ukraine, fears their populations appear to share. One Ipsos survey found three-quarters of French and half of Germans are concerned the Ukraine conflict will spread elsewhere in Europe. Another poll, however, found few Europeans want to pay more for defense. Critics, including Hungary's Viktor Orban, suggest Europe can't afford to defend Ukraine. Others argue Brussels is assuming too much power. Europeans are also divided over whether to invest in their own defense industry or buy externally. The U.S. has been a top supplier.
They will want to continue to sell weapons to European countries.
Former French ambassador Michel Duclos is now an analyst at the Montaigne Institute Research Group in Paris. That's one argument he believes for Washington's short-term commitment to Europe's security.
What I fear more is not exactly that they disengage. It's more than they will want to have Europeans pay more and more for the U.S. protection.
This week sees more high-level meetings on Ukraine and European security. There's another in Paris Wednesday, gathering Europe's five top military powers, along with NATO and Ukrainian defense chiefs. Lisa Bryant, VOA News, Paris.
In other news, late Tuesday, the Republican-controlled U.S. House of Representatives passed a stopgap bill to keep federal agencies funded past Friday, averting a partial shutdown. Mike Johnson is Speaker of the House.
Well, this was a big vote on the House floor. The Republicans stood together, and we had one Democrat vote with us to do the right thing, and that is to fund the government. This was a clean CR. It freezes funding. It's a responsible thing to do.
The bill passed in a nearly party line, 217 to 213 vote, with one Republican voting no and one Democrat voting yes. The bill, which largely keeps the government funded at its current level through the end of September, would need to be passed by the Republican majority Senate and signed by President Trump into law by Friday to avert shutdown. Hakeem Jeffries is the House minority leader. He sums up the Democrats' objections.
Elon Musk is $8 billion a day feeding at the trough of the American taxpayer. This has nothing to do, this bill right here, with waste, fraud, and abuse. It's all part of a broader scheme to pass massive tax cuts for billionaire donors, the wealthy, the well-off, and the well-connected, and then to stick working-class Americans with the bill. This entire scheme. And as Democrats, we want no part of it.
The bill will extend government funding until the end of the fiscal year. Increases in defense, veterans care, and border security would be offset by some cuts to domestic programs.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Philippine ex-president Rodrigo Duterte was arrested on an international warrant as he returned to Manila. Duterte told thousands of cheering Filipino expatriates at a Hong Kong gathering that he was aware the International Criminal Court had issued a warrant for his arrest over his campaign against illegal drugs that left thousands of people dead. He again tried to justify the crackdowns, and the crowd cheered him on.
The European Union wants to increase deportations and is opening the way for return hubs to be set up in third countries for rejected asylum seekers. That's according to a new migration proposal unveiled Tuesday. Only 20% of people with a return order are effectively removed from EU territory. That, according to the European Commission, which presented the European System for Returns as a potential solution. Migrant rights groups say the proposal undermines the right to asylum system.
Pakistani insurgents have attacked a passenger train carrying several hundred people and claim to have taken more than 100 hostages, but officials later said at least 80 were rescued. The fate of the rest wasn't immediately known. Security officials say the attackers blew up the railroad track in southwestern Balochistan province and exchanged fire with security guards on Tuesday. The gunmen used women and children as human shields. The separatist Baloch Liberation Army has claimed responsibility. The train was traveling from the provincial capital of Quetta to Peshawar. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. And now the latest from the U.S.-Canada trade war. After the Ontario premier instituted 25% tariffs on energy imported into northern U.S. states, President Donald Trump doubled the tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum. Caroline Leavitt is White House press secretary.
As for the tariffs, the president made his position on this quite clear with the statement that he put out. And it was a retaliatory statement due to the escalation of rhetoric that we've seen out of Ontario, Canada. The president saw the premier, Doug Ford, make an egregious and insulting comment threatening to shut down electricity for the American people, for hardworking American families. He made that threat. The president saw that and has an obligation and a responsibility to respond accordingly and represent the interests of the American people. So he has made the decision to add a 25% tariff. So now steel and aluminum tariffs will come into effect tomorrow at the rate of 50%. And our steel and aluminum industries have actually applauded these tariffs because, again, they know it's going to grow their industry here. It's going to allow them to export more steel that is made right here in the United States with American workers.
Cooler heads, though, would later prevail. Ontario Premier Doug Ford addressed the media in Toronto on Tuesday, stating that U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick extended an invitation to meet and discuss trade issues immediately instead of waiting until April 2nd. Ford agreed to temporarily suspend countermeasures to allow for negotiations.
So I want to thank Secretary Lutnick for reaching out, putting that olive branch in. I've been in business a number of years, a lot of negotiations, and part of the last negotiation, when someone does that, you have to respect that person for putting out that olive branch, and I'm going to make sure we go down there and have a very good but strong and confident conversation.
Ford emphasized the need for the negotiation, stating that both sides were heated and a discussion was needed to move forward. He thanked Lutnick for the invitation, acknowledging the importance of respecting such gestures in negotiations. However, Ford also made it clear that if the U.S. proceeds with tariffs on aluminum and steel, Canada will respond in kind.
But if he continues with the aluminum and the steel, I just got off the phone with Minister LeBlanc, they will respond dollar for dollar, tariff for tariff.
Trump also blasted Canada for trade protections it has in place on dairy and other agricultural products and threatened to substantially increase duties on cars coming into the U.S. that are set to take effect on April 2nd if other egregious long-time tariffs are not likewise dropped by Canada. The U.S. president shook off market gyrations, telling reporters that markets would go up and down, but he had to rebuild the economy.
In other U.S. news, about 1,300 people at the U.S. Department of Education will lose their jobs as reduction in force notices went out late Tuesday. This is in addition to the 600 people who left voluntarily, slashing the department to about half the size it was when President Trump was inaugurated. Trump's newly appointed Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, says the agency is in its final mission.
And now to the Indian Ocean. The Chagos Islands are one of the last vestiges of the British Empire, and they're currently home to a key U.S. military base. But under pressure from the United Nations, Britain looks set to hand sovereignty of the islands to Mauritius.
Critics say the deal would compromise the security of the region in the face of a growing threat from China, as Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
The Chagos Islands, about 2,500 kilometres east of Madagascar, have been a British colony since 1814. They've been administered from Mauritius, which argues it was illegally forced to give them away in return for its own independence in 1968. Britain forcibly expelled the Chagos Islands population in the 1960s and 70s to make way for a US military base on Diego Garcia, one of the largest islands in the archipelago. In 2019, the International Court of Justice said Britain should cede control of the islands to Mauritius. Now, London is seeking to finalise such a deal. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer told lawmakers last month it was vital to secure the future of the US base.
Without legal certainty, the base cannot operate in practical terms as it should. That is bad for our national security, and it's a gift to our adversaries.
It's reported that Britain will cede sovereignty of the Chagos Islands and pay Mauritius around $116 million a year for 99 years to lease back Diego Garcia and allow the military base to remain. US President Donald Trump said last month that he was inclined to approve the deal. It also has the backing of India, which has close ties to Mauritius. But there are security concerns. Britain's Conservative Opposition Party has described the proposed plan as a strategic disaster for Britain. China has a burgeoning economic relationship with Mauritius. Some fear those ties could compromise the US base on Diego Garcia. Evan Fowler is from the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China, which focuses on threats from Beijing.
Mauritius owes China quite a lot. It uses that to seek sort of political advantage. That area is strategically important to us, and the Chinese understand this too. The Chinese have already been active militarily around the Chagos Islands.
After their expulsion, many Chagossians settled in Mauritius. Thousands also left for Britain. Frankie Bontom and Maxwell Evanor are with the advocacy group Chagossian Voices. They argue Mauritius has never had a rightful claim to their homeland and object to Britain's proposed deal to cede sovereignty.
Once again, we are ignored. People are discussing the future of our homeland without us. We feel like history repeating itself.
We now find ourselves, our very own identity, our very own self, being given to someone else by made of policy without asking us. We are still colonized. We are the lost colony of Africa.
Under the terms of the deal, Chagossians and their families would be able to return to the outer islands in the archipelago, but not to Diego Garcia, which would remain off limits. The Chagossians are eager to return home, but they appear powerless as geopolitical forces shape negotiations over the future of the islands. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
In Africa, there's growing concern over the cuts to American foreign aid. Reuters' Fiona Jones takes us to a special school in Nairobi.
At a children's home in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, children living with HIV/AIDS play. But the staff here fear for their future, as US aid cuts threaten to disrupt their vital drug supply. President Donald Trump's 90-day foreign aid freeze has upended the global supply chain for drugs to fight diseases, including HIV. But it's also blocked the distribution of drugs that long ago reached their destination countries. The manager of Nyumbani Children's Home, Sister Teresa Palakudi, is concerned about access to life-saving HIV meds called antiretrovirals, or ARVs.
If you stop ARVs for these children, there is drug resistance. Afterwards, they will get all kind of opportunistic infections. Then we lose one by one.
The executive director of the home said that if they start purchasing ARVs, a rough estimate is $120 per child per month. And that's without other drugs, including TB medication and food supplements. Meanwhile, on the outskirts of the city, millions of doses of ARVs sit on the shelves of a warehouse, unused and unreachable. A Kenya health official said without US funding, distribution of the $34 million worth of medication sitting there has ceased. An ex-USAID executive said this stock, which Washington has not released funds to distribute, includes 2.5 million bottles of ARVs, 750,000 HIV test kits, and 500,000 malaria treatments. In the meantime, Kenya is scrambling to fill the gaps.
We're dependent on Treasury to release funds.
Kenya's Health Minister, Deborah Barasa, said she expected her government to mobilise funds to allow the supplies to be released within 2 to 4 weeks. But it is not yet clear whether the government has allocated the money to do so. Kenyan Christian charity Meds that runs the warehouse and the US State Department did not respond to requests for comment.
That was Fiona Jones of Reuters reporting.
And finally tonight, if you look up into the night sky on Thursday, the moon may appear to be red. I spoke with astronomer Cameron Hummels at Caltech for an explanation.
So a lunar eclipse is when there's an alignment between the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun. And as you know, the Moon orbits around the Earth, and the Earth orbits around the Sun, and each of those orbits are roughly in the same plane. And so once in a while, you get an alignment where one of them gets directly in between the other two. And in the case of a total lunar eclipse, like what's going to happen later this week, the Moon is on one side, the Sun is on the other, and the Earth is in the middle. And so the Earth is blocking the direct sunlight that would normally hit the Moon and light it up.
So if the Earth is between the Sun and the Moon, no sunlight would be getting to the Moon. How are we going to see it?
Ah, great question. No direct sunlight reaches the Moon. But what happens is the Earth, as we know, has an atmosphere that surrounds it. The light filters through the atmosphere along the edge of the Earth, and it eventually makes its way to the Moon to light it up, although in a modified way than the direct sunlight normally would.
So on a normal night, the Moon appears to be white. What will it look like during an eclipse?
During an eclipse, it doesn't look white, it looks red. And the reason for that is our atmosphere, because of the size of the molecules and the oxygen and the nitrogen, it scatters blue light, which is why when you look up during the day sky, in clear sky, you see blue all around. That's the scattered blue light. But the red light continues unabated in its original path. And that's the light that strikes the Moon and lights it up and causes it to appear red during a lunar eclipse.
Now, it seems that lunar eclipses come along somewhat frequently. They're not terribly special, but this one coming up is getting a lot of press. Why is that?
One of the reasons is, for the first time really in history, we have a mission that's sitting on the surface of the Moon right now. There was this mission, private mission that landed on the Moon a couple of weeks ago called Blue Ghost. And it's taking data of the surroundings and such. But one of the things that it will be able to do is take images of the Earth during this lunar eclipse. Now, that's particularly interesting because from the perspective of someone on the Moon during this event, it'll look like a lunar eclipse. It'll look like the Earth passing in front of the Sun and all the direct sunlight being snuffed out. But then this filtered kind of red circular halo of light around the Earth passing directly to us. So it should be pretty significant and create some amazing images that we'll be able to see in the weeks.
Well, let me ask something else. You started this off by saying that the Moon revolves around the Earth, and then both the Moon and the Earth together are revolving around the Sun.
Yes.
If the Moon is going around the Earth, why isn't there an eclipse every day?
Great question. The Moon takes about a month to make a full orbit around the Sun, or around the Earth. That's why we have the term month. It comes from the period at which the Moon makes an orbit around the Earth. So even if we were perfectly aligned, where the Moon were in a perfect orbit that's flat and collinear with the Earth's orbit around the Sun, you'd only have them once a month. However, there's a slight offset of a few degrees between our orbit around the Sun and the Moon's orbit around us. And so this doesn't happen every period. It doesn't happen every time it makes a cycle. It only happens maybe once a year or so.
So if this is happening Thursday night,
will
people all over the Earth be able to see it?
No, unfortunately not. Only the people who have the Moon visible in the night sky at the time when this alignment precisely takes place will be able to see it.
So where is the best place to watch it?
The best place to watch it will be North and South America. On the west coast of the United States, the Pacific Daylight Time, it'll be visible in the night sky basically from about 11:30 at night until 1:30 or so in the morning. Whereas on the east coast, it'll be obviously 3 hours later around, you know, 5 in the morning. Whereas if you're in, say, South America, in Sao Paulo or Buenos Aires, you might be able to see it early in the morning on Friday, March 14th, between, you know, 3 a.m. and 6 a.m.
And we'll leave it there for today. Cameron Hummels is the head of the Astronomy Outreach Office at Caltech. Mr. Hummels, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for explaining this to us.
Happy to help.
That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.